Words are extraordinarily important, not just because they're things that you say, but because every word is defined with respect to a mental structure called a frame, and every word calls up some sort of set of ideas, a structure of ideas in our brains. And if you've learned a word, then you've learned the frame that goes with that word, and it is part of your brain.
That's George Lakoff. He's a professor of linguistics at UC Berkeley and senior fellow of the Rockridge Institute. Lakoff says the study of linguistics is not pie-in-the-sky academia. Understanding how words are used is a study in practical politics. Lakoff says politicians use words on purpose, and it's about time we know what they mean. Steve Paulson caught up with George Lakoff to discuss American political rhetoric.
Now, there are a lot of loaded words out there, loaded phrases that we almost take for granted in the way politicians talk. One is tax relief. Tell me about that phrase.
Well, take relief first. Relief has a frame. There's an affliction. There's an afflicted party who's harmed by it. There's a reliever who takes the affliction away as a kind of hero, and if you try to stop him, you're a bad guy because you're making the affliction continue. If you add tax to that, you get a conceptual metaphor. Taxation is an affliction. So when you have tax relief, automatically you get the relief frame with the metaphor added on that says taxation is an affliction to everybody, that it should be taken away, that someone who offers tax relief is a hero, and anyone who tries to stop it is a bad guy.
Now, there's another phrase that I'm very curious about, war on terror, which we started to hear after the 9/11 attacks. And I guess what I find curious is that the word terror is used rather than terrorism.
Well, or terrorists, which is even more interesting. Terror is a state, an emotional state. And it's an emotional state that arises from things that are threatening to you. And, of course, war is interesting in itself because it was originally called a crime. Within the first couple of hours, the administration referred to 9/11 as a crime. And, in fact, for some days, Colin Powell argued that it should be considered a crime rather than a war and that war powers shouldn't be given. But the word war evokes war powers. It says we've got a commander-in-chief, we have special circumstances, and the commander-in-chief can, you know, do whatever he needs to do, and that gives special powers to the president. Terror is something that doesn't go away. It's an emotional state. You can't defeat terror. It makes no sense. You can defeat, perhaps, armies in a war. But there are no armies with terrorists. What you've got with terrorists are isolated groups and cells who may be operating on their own. There is no such thing as a war, a battleground, a peace treaty, or anything like that.
And I'm wondering if using the word terror broadens the scope. I mean, if you talk about terrorists, are you really talking about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden? But if you open it up to terror, can you expand that war to go after more enemies?
Exactly. You can go after whatever enemies you declare to be causing fear or threatening you. So what it does is allow for an indefinitely long war, an ongoing war in which the president has special war powers forever.
Now, in terms of creating catchphrases that communicate information but that also obscure certain realities, one of the smartest has to be collateral damage. I mean, we're not talking civilian deaths. We're talking collateral damage, as if we're not even talking about human beings who are dying.
Exactly. The phrase is originally taken from the idea that when you drop a bomb on a target, you may hit something to the side, damage another building. And then, of course, it extends from buildings to people. And so collateral damage turns out to mean citizens who are killed or maimed. In general, the term collateral damage is a term that hides what it means. And that is, I think, a disastrous thing, especially when talking about war.
Now, I know there are some people who say that President Bush often uses coded words when he gives a speech, that these words will resonate particularly with his followers on the religious right, whereas for a secular audience, they'll just sort of go over their heads. Do you think that's true?
Well, let me give you an example of that. Take No Child Left Behind. And notice it was changed from Leave No Child Behind, which was Marianne Edelman's phrase. Left Behind is from the idea that after Armageddon, the good people will go to heaven and the bad people will be left behind. That's the term, left behind. You hear left behind if you're a fundamentalist Christian, and that's the reference. What that says is that some people are better than others, that there are people who pass the test and people who fail the test who are left behind. Now, what they want to do in this is change public schools. The idea here is to support religious schools through vouchers and other things, but also to impose testing, to divide children into those who are the good children and those who are the bad children and should be left behind. And, of course, the idea of no child left behind is, in reality, a case of Orwellian language, because what that does is take away money from the public schools, you know, and taking away money from teaching, therefore making it more likely that poor children will be left behind.
Now, many of the words we've been talking about tend to be used by conservatives in power, conservative politicians, and it does raise the question of whether conservatives have been more effective at co-opting the language of political discourse. And I guess it raises the question of why haven't liberals done a better job of getting their own catchphrases into everyday discourse?
Well, it's not just the catchphrases. Remember that the catchphrases have surface frames and they have to fit deep fundamental frames. So the real question is, why haven't the liberals been better at getting their fundamental values and ideas out there? There are several deep reasons for this. One is that the conservatives have, over the past 35 years, built between 40 and 80 major think tanks. They're funded at about $400 million a year, about half $1 billion a year, just going into think tanks that work on these issues. In addition, they have training institutes to train conservatives how to think. And the Leadership Institute in Virginia, for example, has over 10 years trained more than 26,000 conservative leaders. And then they have a private company run by Frank Luntz, Frank Luntz Research, that puts out books, training manuals, to train, to take the best and most effective language from the think tanks, to take the ideas and arguments from the think tanks and put them together in a training manual.
Well, this sounds just like good politics. I mean, if you can control the language, you're doing well. I guess it raises the question of, you know, why hasn't the other side been so effective?
Well, there are real reasons why the liberals and Democrats didn't do this, even though they had just as much money. The history of liberal thought begins in the Enlightenment with the idea of rationalism, that everybody is equally rational, which is why we can govern ourselves and don't depend on kings or the church. And as rational beings, it's irrational to be against your self-interest, so that a rational liberal government would act rationally for the self-interest of everyone. And therefore, if you just told people the truth, they would reason to the right conclusion. That is false, and that's where liberals have gotten hung up. Because people really think in terms of frames and metaphors, not in terms of formal logic or Cartesian logic. Because of that, and because the frames are there in your brain, simply telling someone a fact that doesn't fit the frames will not result in their using the facts. The facts will bounce off the frames. And this is the sad part. Liberals assume that because they were putting the truth out there and doing the science and doing the social science, that therefore the truth would set them free. And it didn't. Instead, what happened was the conservatives, knowing better, built a system of think tanks, of training facilities, took over a lot of the media, as they're doing now, even on NPR right now, and are getting their ideas out there. And once they do that, even commentators, even journalists, will hear these words over and over and get them into their brains, and they will seem like common sense to them.
So it sounds like you're also saying that we in the media are partly to blame for this. I mean, you're pretty upfront about you are a liberal yourself, and you are saying that the conservatives have essentially co-opted the political language out there, but you're also saying that the media are complicit.
Absolutely. The media are complicit, but not in a simple way, not like they know they're complicit. I occasionally give lectures in journalism school classes. And when I talk about this, the students will say things like, oh, but we are taught to be objective, who, what, when, where, etc. And we assume that language is objective. But language is not objective. And that's the point.
George Lakoff's latest book is called Don't Think of an Elephant. Know Your Values, Frame the Debate. Steve Paulson spoke with him.